Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
It is Thursday, so the Mensa brothers join me from outside of Kansas City, Will Cosentini. Will, how are you?
I'm grand. It's fully fall here in the great Midwest, raining in the 40s.
Nice. Congratulations on that. From McAllen, Texas, Tim, welcome. And can you give us a weather update? Tim?
Sunny and in the upper 90s.
Sunny in the upper 90s. Wow. And Jeff Kenny joins us. He is from, he's out in 29 Palms, I believe. He's from Connecticut. And Jeffrey is from Connecticut. And how's the weather? Pretty nice days, I've noticed, in 29 Palms, Jeff.
Yeah, not bad. Up into early 90s today, and no wind or anything like that. Not bad at all. But I'm doing an inside job, so it's, hard to tell.
The weather's always nice.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
All right. And in San Clemente, in Costa Mesa, Newport Beach today, it was a gorgeous day. I think 75 degrees, so not going to hear me complain. Does anybody know Major General Neary other than in a casual way? Will?
No, I don't. No.
Tim?
No, I've known Steve since we were lieutenants, but we never served together. I know him pretty well.
Okay. Jeff?
I just know him from TBS.
Got it.
I mean, when we were instructors there,
All right. I think the most accurate reporting I've seen on this was done by the Wall Street Journal. The headline says that top Marine general in Europe relieved for repeating a racial slur. And when you read the story, what it sounds like is somewhere adjacent to where he was, there were Marines PTing, and there was music on, and that music contained the N-word. And he walked over and used the N-word, asking them, how would you like it if somebody like me used that word? They were evidently aghast. They contacted Stars and Stripes, and he was ultimately relieved earlier this week. So, Will, thoughts on that?
A couple of things. One, I hope there's a hell of a lot more to the story.
Yes.
If that caused his relief. The second thing is, I've not been a big aficionado of rap music over my life. But recently, I've heard a lot more of it, just because some of the people that I interact with. And it's absolutely appalling to me what a lot of the lyrics are that people will just be singing along to and not even paying attention to what they're saying. That if you said that stuff in polite company, you'd be, exorcised from the area. So, again, I hope there's a lot more to that story that causes a relief of a two-star general, but who knows?
Got it. Tim, your thoughts on it?
I would not be surprised if there is not more to this story. It would mean Steve now joins a company with several university presidents and prominent businessmen for using that specific word as an example of not to use offensive words. And just by the fact that they were lacking in melanin, that alone made them automatically canceled. It's a cancel culture move. Does anybody honestly believe Steve Neary's a racist, that he harbored very retrograde views about African Americans? Of course not. That's not even contention here. The fact of the matter is that a subordinate heard him say something, took offense, as we've seen time and time again in our colleges, and ran it up the flagpole, and our leadership in a craven manner folded automatically because of the magic N-word, and I'm infuriated by it. Steve Neer is a good man, and he did not deserve, I believe, this kind of behavior. But I doubt any of the other college presidents and board members of major businesses, those guys that have gotten the same treatment, I doubt they earned it either.
Jeff, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm of two minds this. My first mind is to agree with Timmy, you know, that, you know, this is all the investment put in this guy through the years, and have something so trivial knock him away, you know, is stupid, in my opinion. On the other hand, you know, we've all been brought up for this stuff, and you can't – it's like it's horrible, but the truth of it is, you know things you can't do. You can't say, men, if you're going to go out there and drink and drive, make sure you drive fast and get home. You know? You can't say certain – you can't even joke about certain things anymore, and you can't you can't say this word anymore. You can say any other ethnic slur about any other, like, European. Like, you can talk about Guineas, you can talk about mixed Polacks and so on. Nobody will say shit, particularly if you are one, you know. But even if you're a black person, you stand in peril saying this word unless you're using the right context. So it's a sign of our times. And in the way that, you know, you don't use certain roads that haven't been cleared of IEDs, you don't drive down this road. And not knowing that meant the guy either didn't give a shit anymore because he's sick of the hypocrisy, or he just – his judgment is faltering. You know what I mean? It's tragic. But, I mean, we have – if you want to hang around, you got to put up with this shit, you know? And if it's what it sounds like, it sounds like he's saying, hey, look, this is a horrible thing. What if I was to sing a song like this where we're PTing? If he never said – I don't even know for sure if he actually said the word. But if he said – you know, if he did say that, he'd be right. He'd say, what if I said something like this? What would you guys think?
So that's almost verbatim the way the event supposedly went, which was how would you feel if I used that – and he says the word.
Right.
But it's in.
Oh, he did say.
It's in the context of correcting somebody and telling them to shut that off. Let me ask you each this, and we'll go around again. Two questions. One, if you were the commandant, and assuming there's nothing else to the story, that in the context of correcting these Marines, that a major general in the Marine Corps used that word and asked them, how would you like it if I used and said that word? How would you have handled it? And then what about the people that are playing this? Well, you can't put your tool time calendar up anymore, right, with girls in bikinis using tools in your company office or wherever. Can't do that because it's demeaning, and we wouldn't do that anymore. You cannot hang the Confederate, you know, battle colors up anywhere in public in the Marine Corps anymore because it's divisive. So, I mean, if there's going to be no tolerance for that word, shouldn't it be no tolerance? And do you think – so the second part of the question is, should the commandant do the same thing with that word? And that music is not allowed to be played in anything but your headset, if that's what you want to listen to. But anything that graces the public airwaves on a Marine Corps installation will not include that word. And if you do, you do so at the peril of your career. So to me, there's zero tolerance, as I've shown with Major General Neary, and I will show zero tolerance for anybody else who thinks that that's good judgment to play something like that. Is that just the same? That's just the logical extension of the logic applied in the Confederate battle colors. No, zero tolerance for things that are disrespectful and divisive. So, Will, those two questions: how would you have handled it, and should he in turn do that with the N-word?
Yeah, so item one, if, as you just described, that's what Neary did, then if I was the commandant, I would reinforce that. I wouldn't fire the guy. I'd reinforce it. The second thing is, if I'm the commandant, I am very careful about being the language police. I would much rather tell people that there are things that are appropriate and there are things that are inappropriate. And commanders, sergeant majors, staff NCOs, you know what's appropriate. Enforce good order, morale, and discipline. And you know what? Every once in a while, someone will get over the line and you slap them around. But if you got to get down to writing your own dictionary of inappropriateness, there's better things that the commandant should be doing.
Yep. All right. All right. Tim, your thoughts on those two subjects?
I echo Will. If I was sitting in the commandant's chair and this came up, I would absolutely back up Neary. I might because I sometimes fantasize about being a commandant and the kind of crap you could pull. I might reach down and get Dave Chappelle and bring him on board as my cultural advisor, because the alternative, what you were talking about, is banning rap music. If you're saying, well, we're not going to tolerate that word in any of its form, you're banning Dave Chappelle comedy shows and you're banning rap music. I would not want to lose Dave Chappelle personally. But that's the thing. You would say, well, I guess that word is too daggone poisonous. We're not going to tolerate it in any form at all, period. And you can't do that.
But that's the way he treated General Neary, though.
Oh, of course that's how he treats General Neary. It only goes one way, though. It always goes one way. It doesn't come back the other way. You can't then say, oh, I'm going to ban all this rap music because that word is a poison word.
No, we can't ever hear that word again. Let me tell you, that word isn't in all rap music, right?
I don't think so.
Right, so my policy, Commandant McNamara, is, hey, look, we have zero tolerance for that. Zero. If that's in, if you want to watch Dave Chappelle, put your headset on and watch Dave Chappelle. I'm not telling you can't watch it, but it cannot grace the public airwaves at a Marine Corps installation, period.
Yeah, but Mac, then you're banning books, burning books.
No, I'm not burning anything. No burning books.
You got to take books out of the library.
No, you can lay your eyeballs on the book.
Are you going to allow them to use those books in schools?
That's a little bit beyond my purview, so I don't really have a say in that. But whatever you consume privately is not the, you know, like if you wanted to read a book about the Confederate battle flag or books, that's nobody has an issue with that. Go ahead.
Do you want them to teach To Kill a Mockingbird?
I don't have any issue with teaching To Kill a Mockingbird. What the commandant's policy is, right, is the public display. Is airing it in public while we're PTing during working hours in a public setting, we're playing this music. Cannot do that. Logical extension of the battle colors edict. That's what I'm saying. You guys both say no.
Well, do I get to talk?
No, not yet.
No,
Jeffrey.
I'm only saying that an active ban of I don't see how that doesn't get a lot of pushback. I like the way it is.
He didn't give a shit about the pushback on the battle colors thing. He just said that we're doing it. It's done. Boom.
Yeah, but there's no cultural pushback. It only goes one way. It goes against.
It can't go. Aren't we supposed to stand up for what's right and what's true and be consistent or no?
I'm talking about the amount of hassle he would generate in backlash by trying to deprive a certain segment of the Marine Corps of their cultural heritage.
So what you're saying is the Confederate battle colors thing is pandering. Right to the current events that have gone on since the spring.
It's a non-issue.
And not about
who gives a shit about the Confederate battle flag. Nobody gives a shit about it. There's a lot of young Marines that give a shit about rap music, though. That's a different animal, bro.
Got it. Did you weigh in on what you would do? Were you the commandant? You would hire Dave Chappelle as your cultural advisor.
I'm bringing my cultural advisor, Dave Chappelle. I think the commandant's got that kind of power.
Got it. All right, Jeffrey, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's already the stipulation, there's already the sanction against obscene and racial overtone, you know, Jody's and just speech in general. And if you're able to sing and think of, you know, sing and do rap lyrics and everything while you're PTing, you're not PTing hard enough, man. I mean, so I would just say, hey, look, you know, here's the rules. Just like I think Will said in the beginning, here's the guidance. You know, none of this stuff can be uttered, you know, as being seen as being authorized by Marine Corps units. So if you do it, you're doing it at your own peril. And if I find out, you're fired. You know, you get fired. And so consequently, they'll just fucking PT them, and they won't do that shit. You know, I mean, well, we like to have our music. Well, fuck you. You ain't gonna have your music. You know, it's you're there to PT. It's just like you don't bring.
Are
a
you
politics
hold on, hold on? Are you being the commandant right now with that attitude? I'm confused.
The commandant, I just say, hey, look, here's the rule about sanctioned speech and any kind of speech that is, you know, prejudicial regarding different races, different religions, different cultures, different sexual orientations,
right.
And then, you know, and then also slang that slants the term is prohibited. It's already in the books. So when you can't go put on a record player where somebody's singing about bitches and hoes, you know, you can't do it. If you do it,
what do you mean? That's bitches, that isn't. I mean, you know. Right. That's the standard fare of rap music, right?
Well, then you ain't fucking doing rap music when you're PTing.
Oh, here we go. Time. Now you're in with me.
You're not doing any music during your PT.
See,
time.
There you go.
You're all doing right. John Philip fucking Sousa, man. God damn it.
All right. What about if you're a commandant, what do you do with Major General Neary?
I wouldn't fire him. I'd say I go with what Will said. I'd back up his message, you know, and then say, hey, one more fucking time, you're fired, motherfucker. You know, I mean, I wouldn't fire him over that. That means these motherfuckers are now going to think all we got to do is bitch about fucking Major General. He's gone. Right. And they're all high fiving. Let me tell you something. When I went in to relieve the guy who I never met, the guy who got fired in Pittsburgh when I went up there, right. He was gone before I got there. But Verge told me, Verge Palumbo, was up there. They had all hands run by the XO, and these fucking recruiters who were shitbirds were high fiving because they got him fired. And you know, so that's the ugly truth about the Marine Corps. There's people like that in, and they celebrate, you know, the demise of commanders, particularly hard commanders. And I'll tell you right now, the hardest commander I know of in my lifetime, who was doing a very effective job, because I have high ranking. I mean, I'm talking field grade officers tell me he did a good job. And then I have my son, who is a Lance Corporal working for him, Asad Khan. That guy got fired because he was too hard for the guy who was running, you know, who was in charge of him. And the guy used him long enough to get the benefit from him. In a very challenging place, they're up there by Kandahar, Afghanistan, and stuff. And then, when it was safe, he fired him. And that injustice is something that all commanders, you know, it's part of the peril of all commanders now. I believe you want to be effective. You know, your effectiveness is going to cause friction because people will resist being forced to do things that they have to do in order to be effective, and they will come back at you. And one of the ways they come back at you is similar to what happened to Major General Neary, I think.
Now I want to ask one more question. You're the commandant during these times today, right? You just got beamed into his office today. You're presiding over the Marine Corps during this time. You don't really want to see the door. Does that change? Does that change what you do, Will?
I'm not. I don't know if I get. I don't know if I understand the question.
Does Berger given the political winds and you know? I mean. To me, everybody is just saying, yeah, Major General Neary, he's dead man walking, no matter what he did. If that word came out of his mouth, he's dead man walking, because who's going to go to bat for that?
Right.
Hey, we'll just send somebody else over there. I mean, the juice ain't worth the squeeze. So is that just a reality that General Berger's dealing with? Or is this something that he should stand up and say, you know what? My responsibility is to be fair to everybody, right? And I know Steve Neary, and I know what he's about. And I can tell you what, maybe he was wrong in the way he corrected this, but for me to relieve him and say that I've lost confidence in him, you know, would be wrong, because I haven't.
Yeah. So let's lay out the scenario. If Neary did not use the word to slur anyone, but used it as an example, as in saying, boom, how would you like it if I called you that stuff that you guys are broadcasting out here on the PT field? If that's the scenario, yes. So it's completely benign, all right, then, you know, the commandant does have two prongs. Item one is he's the caretaker of the institution, and when you get right down to it, your average two-star general doesn't mean shit to the institution. Right. On the other hand, he's the caretaker of the institution, and doing the right thing is central to the core of the institution. And so he's got to calculate a little bit, and he may have to go in there to the SecNav's office and the SecDef's office and explain it to those people if they're blockheads. And then he's got to see, is the damage to the Marine Corps worth it or not? Unfortunately, that's part of his job. I would hope that if it's a benign example like that, that there was no slur, and that we've got some panty waists that are a little bit overly sensitive, or perhaps don't particularly care for them and like to see a scalp on their belt, then the commandant should be a man and stand up.
And then have that conversation with SecNav, SecDef. When they look at him and say, hey, you know,
if it comes up, if they want to bring that up, then I'm just wondering who's worrying about the defense of the nation. That's just me.
All right.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we are worried about that.
All right. So, but the bottom line for you though is if there was no slur intended at all, then he stays.
If a reasonable observer could say, you got to be kidding me. He was not slurring anyone. He was trying to embarrass people by the language in order to get them to understand that this is not appropriate.
Got it.
If that's the scenario, if that's a fireable offense, then you need to break out a new dictionary and tell everyone all the words that are fireable.
Yep.
Got it. All right. Tim, any thoughts on that?
I think that the way that Vito just laid it out is the most likely way. I don't think there's a chance in hell Steve Neary was yelling that as an epitaph at somebody. I think that's absurd to think of. And the president had just signed into law a presidential directive removing critical race theory training from the federal workplace. If there was ever a time for a commandant to stand up against the mob, the brain social justice mob, and say, no, I know this guy. This isn't what this is about. He was right. Now would be the time to do it. But we don't expect that kind of leadership from our generals these days anymore. I would be shocked if he had done that. He did what we expect all of them to do, which is, whoops, hot potato, cut him off at the knees. We've got to keep steering this beast in this weird direction we're going towards, you know, force 2030 or whatever.
Got it. Jeff, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Timmy on that one. To expect the commandant to go that way is—it probably should happen. I think it should happen, you know, because you know, it's obvious that Neary was trying to teach a lesson here against racism, and maybe he said the word, which is—if is that all it is? It's just the utterance of the word, you know, in that context. then it's we're really in the George Orwell times. You know, is that really what it is? I mean, we all know that's what it is, though. If you say that word and you're in a certain position, there's no context where it's acceptable anymore. And it's just not right. How do you talk about something, frankly, when you can't even use a word? And, you know, like there's other words, of course, that you can use. I don't want to get, you know, wrapped around that axle, but the word, basically what the comment is saying is, look, you know, we live in a society filled with hypocrisy, but this hypocrisy has certain rules. And if you break this cardinal rule, you will go.
We don't, obviously, we haven't seen the statements and the preliminary
right.
investigation, so we don't know. Right. But to me, the only, if the commandant finds that in the course of correcting them, he said that word, and to me, he should bring Neary back to Washington, D.C. He should have his own little press conference, and he should, you know, spell out what I expect of every Marine, right? And, you know, General Neary is here today. He's going to explain what happened. We have other Marines that were here, that were there that day, and we're gonna talk to them. And we're going to get this out in the open. We're going to have a grown-up conversation about it, you know. And if you, and but to me, I agree with you. In this day and age, we're going to do. Somebody's going to actually treat this like a serious issue and act like a grown-up, and do what's right. If there was no malice, or you know, if he was only using it, you know, while he was correcting. And again, I don't know that. We're all assuming that because I've only heard. I've only heard good things about Steve Neary. He was in Iraq, I think, a couple different times when I was there. And I only heard good things about him as a battalion commander and as an officer. And so I don't know him beyond that. And so, I what Tim said, though, resonates with me. Look, the guys I know, and present company included, they didn't give a shit what color you were. Honestly, they didn't give a shit what gender you were. If you're a Marine and you got a job to do, right, the currency, the coin of the realm, is your performance. Either you do it or you don't. And if you're a baller, nobody gives a shit about any of that. And those are the people that I know. Those are the people I've served with. And I'll tell you what, those are people who die for each other. And so, interesting times. But none of that. And again, the other thing is. No really explanation. Major General Neary relieved because the commandant lost confidence in him. So, I mean, to me, there's a question there of, you know, and at some point somebody will FOIA the investigation and it will come out what he said. And so if it was in the course of correcting, I think, you know, probably the commandant could have done a little bit better in this case, but I guess we will wait and see. Any final thoughts before we move on? What's that?
Yeah, put out a policy letter. Hey, look, I don't want to hear racial epithets or gender epithets or anything like this during PT. I don't care what kind of music you use, but I don't want to hear that shit because it's offensive to some people to hear the N word, to hear the B word. I mean, bitches, right? To hear, you know, or whatever. You know, what I mean, there's a million fucking. Just say, look, none of it. None of it's appropriate. If you just put that policy out. But here's the thing. You know, the guy's blood is up, I think, and he wants to fix it right now. That's what an officer does. You don't wait for this shit. You fix it right then and there. And so I would just say, you always ask me, what's a better way to handle it? Call in like a buffer guy, you know, the guy who's actually in charge of the thing, you know, and be very careful what you say to him. Make sure your sergeant major's there. You know, there's different ways of handling it. But, you know. I think the spirit was good, but you know, the method is what got him fired.
Will, Tim, any final comments?
No, thank you.
We're heading towards the Royal Marines. Have you ever seen a Royal Marine Sergeant Major chewing somebody's ass? Because they never cuss. They never, ever cuss. And that's where we're heading. I don't think that's American. I'm impressed by British guys that can chew people out and not cuss. But that's exactly where we're heading towards, is a military where we can't even use the F word. And I don't even know how to fucking talk without saying that. But that's
Starship Enterprise. Starship Enterprise.
Yeah.
Well, let me just tell you, if you can't express yourself without the use of profanity, then you're certainly a lower form of life. I mean, all you have to do is follow my footsteps, and you'll find that you don't actually need it to exist.
That's what the Brits would say, and I'm calling bullshit on it. It's not right.
No.
I actually got
the same stupid shit. It's perfect.
I actually got that out of my mouth without choking. The commandant obviously in a difficult situation, right? You know, the whole nation's up in arms about everything. But I think, you know, again, if not knowing the results of the investigation, if all he was doing is correcting, the commandant had a chance, in my opinion, and it's lost, and that is, you know, all this isn't black and white, right? There is gray area in there, and his job is to clear that up, right? But whatever. All right, second subject is the article. The Fantasy of MCDP-1 by Lieutenant Colonel Thaddeus Drake, goes by Thad. I thought it was pretty interesting. Both his, first of all, the development of MCDP-1 and how long it has, you know, existed in its current form. So, Jeff, we'll start with you. His major theses are, or the premises of his paper are, that it needs to be rewritten. There's communication realities that aren't really taken into effect, he didn't think. And also, tactical missions need to be upgraded. Give me your thoughts on the paper in general, and what do you think?
Well, I appreciate him writing it, but I disagree with him because the whole point of the thing is not to spell out how you're supposed to do things. This is how you split a leg that's been broken. This is how you put a machine gun into action. This is how you lay in a gun line with an aiming circle. That's not the idea. The idea is a way of thought, you know? And so I think with that being in mind, I mean, that's the way you should approach, you know, MCDP-1.
All right. Tim, your thoughts?
Yeah, reading that article, it seemed like the same old stuff with the attritionists back when we were, you know, lieutenants and captains. Only the guy writes better, and his name Thaddeus. You thought he would be a maneuverist just with that, but I've got to take some contention in his examples. For instance, he says you'd never see where we would break down into very small, like squad sized formations and let them operate on commander's intent. But I saw you guys do exactly that in the Helmand province with those little combat outposts everywhere. So that's not true. And I also would submit to you, and I don't know, but I can pretty much guess that when Will was told to take his LAV, his light armored a battalion out to the Syrian border, he probably wasn't told specifically exactly a laundry list of things to do, but generally what it was General Mattis was looking for him to accomplish and what he expected to hear back from him. And that's MCDP-1. So I think he's wrong like that, but I don't for a second doubt that he's right about the current state of micromanagement, because I was reading the Tempest book. Why am I forgetting his name all of a sudden?
When the Tempest Gathers.
Yeah. Yeah, when the Andy, Tempest Gathers.
Andy,
and I was
Andy Milburn.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was reading Andy's. I was looking for stuff that I could use to fluff my article up, my argument with, and I did. But the amount of micromanagement he was dealing with as a colonel, task force commander, was infuriating. So, but that again is not that has nothing to do with MCDP-1 either. That's a weird lash up out there, when he's working for an army general. So I would be uncomfortable with a gigantic reworking of this thing with an eye towards integrating technology into our thought process. I don't like it. I just like the thought process. I think that it served us well when we had to get out and shoot and move and communicate in a big way in 2003 and 2004.
Got it. Will?
Yeah, I actually went back and found my copy of MCDP-1 and realized that this book is not as good as FMFM-1 was. Mm-hmm. So MCDP-1 was revised in 1997, and they put some crap in there that's just not as good as the original. And it's four chapters. Chapter 1, Nature of War. Chapter 2, Theory of War, I think, stand alone pretty well. I agree with a couple of his arguments, and the biggest one to me, where the Marine Corps has failed in implementing this idea of warfighting, is in manpower. We haven't changed our manpower system since at least the all-volunteer force, and there is no thought of trust, et cetera, within the manpower system. And I would say maybe contrary to my friends here, but we perhaps lived in MCDP-1 in 2003. But I don't think we did from 2004 till today. Where was our bid for victory? Where was our concentration? We didn't do the big things. We sustained and we broke all kinds of things. For example, when I deployed, RCT-7 was regimental headquarters, two battalions from 7th Marines, three battalions from 7th Marines, two from 29 Palms, and then 3-4 was at Okinawa. And then 1st LAR, well, 3rd LAR was sitting back at home. So they could have had a cohesive unit. And then imagine what RCT-1 looked like at that time. I got to think about it a little bit. They had 2-2 from the East Coast. They had 2-1. What other units were? I mean, it was a gobbledygook over there.
They always were.
Yeah, and so when push came to shove, we ignored all of that stuff. We didn't live it. So I am very sympathetic to his argument in that. And the other thing, which I think he brings up a little bit, is this idea of risk. You know, MCDP-1 warfighting is a risk-taking philosophy. We are not a risk-taking organization. We take risk because we don't recognize it sometimes. Very rarely, at least in my limited combat experience, do we truly take risk and understand risk. And I got to tell you something. I was in many ways very risk averse out there. We didn't have a lot of force, but when we knew that we had to take a hard point, I made sure that I had absolutely overwhelming force in that spot because combat gets random. And I wanted people to know you don't have a chance against us, just surrender. So maybe that's the way you're supposed to calculate risk. I took risk in other places. But I don't think he's arguing that it needs a complete rewrite. I think he's arguing that it makes people cynical when you hear about trust tactics and mission orders, and then you get a 750-page checklist before you deploy. Those things take a little nuance to explain to people that have been hearing about. And
well, he calls that what, the say-do gap, right?
Yeah, and it's there. you know, when we're, you know, our adult lives, minus Jeff in Liberia for a couple of months, and minus me in Sierra Leone for a few days, and I don't know what Tim's experience was, you know, combat experience before that time, it was pretty limited. So we spent our whole career getting ready for this. And I got to tell you something. When I got to Iraq and saw Salsa Night an NCO school where they were importing swords so that they could teach a corporal's course.
Make you throw up.
Those things are not a warfighting MCDP-1 focused organization. One man's opinion. And so we should think that through. And I'll tell you, I was in AWS and General Mundy came down and I forget what I think it was a tailhook thing. And we were going to have a big, you know, stand down for tailhook. We had to focus on it. And I remember that guy Smith at TBS, Captain Smith. I forget his first name. He stood up and asked a commandant when we were going to have a Marine Corps-wide stand down on FMFM1 because it's obvious that it had not penetrated the force by that time. General Mundy was good. He says, "Captain, that's a good idea." He pointed his aide to write it down. And then he didn't do shit about it. But yeah, the Marine Corps really needs to look at it. And I tell you, the manpower thing is big. Manpower is 65% of our budget. It's the essence of who we are, a people organization. And it's run straight out of the 1970s at best.
Wow. How you don't feel strongly, Will. Holy shit.
Hey, I told three separate, you know, assistant commandants of the Marine Corps the same thing. None of them disagreed with me.
Well, I would tell you, I don't know that we've ever done maneuver warfare. I think most the generals that were in a position to do that had varying degrees of understanding of it. I think they had, and those who understood it had varying degrees of comfort with it. And so I don't really think we did it. I think we used different buzzwords, but we didn't do it. I mean, and if you were in an OPT or a crossover brief or something like that where you're going to, you know, you're going to execute this thing, and you said something like this. Well, are we going to put them in any kind of a dilemma in this operation at all? You got the quit being a fucking dick, Mac. Look, right? That's what look you got. Like, well, I mean, it is our doctrine, right? I mean, you know, is this the only option? Is there no other way you know, to get after the quote unquote system and unravel it without doing just this? Hey, man, don't do that in front of, you know, when Colonel Umpty Frats is here. All right, got it. Sorry. I thought I was supposed to be honest in that forum. Never mind. So I don't think we ever did. I think the chief benefit of the maneuver warfare thing in the Marine Corps was the professional education of the officer corps, I believe, chiefly. And then later on, the staff and CO Corps, I believe that the education level, the reading list and all that contributed to more, you know, reading in it. Are we comfortable with it? Do we do it? Not that I saw. And all the different ways that you can watch people, be they with you know, different feeds of different, aviation platforms, you can look in somebody's Merc windows and you can watch all that. I mean, talk about the ability to get the 8,000-foot screwdriver out. You know, when the President of the United States and the Secretary of State and the Vice President are huddled around a monitor watching SEALs, you know, kill Osama bin Laden, you know, I mean, that's out there. You can do that. And the technology is better now. So my own opinion is I think the OPT ought to be, let's look at the say-do gap and let's get real. And, you know, and if it means that we have to revise our doctrinal, our foundational pub, because I think, you know, FMFM1 and MCDP1 are aspirational in nature. This is the way we want to fight. But I haven't seen it. So Is it? Should we leave it out there as an aspirational document, or should we make it more attuned to the things we actually do? That's a question. So, Jeff, should it be revised to reduce the say do gap, or should it be left in its current form to, you know, to remain aspirational in nature, to inspire people to achieve that?
Yes, because here's what happened, and my view of what happened in Iraq. And even before that in Afghanistan, is that the, you know, in Iraq,
FMFM1 and MCDP1 were fulfilled by the way our forces did OIF1. And that's maneuver warfare. That's how you do it. It wasn't perfect, no, but they were trying. And then this thing became a coin. They even announced it was a counterinsurgency operation. After April 2004, where all those guys got that horrible fighting they had unexpectedly in Ramadi, which bled into Fallujah and so forth. And that 2004, that time frame was the last time we should have been in front of this thing. They should have shoved those Iraqi formations up there in front. Fucked up and incompetent as they were, let them develop situations and then send in our guys as QRFs and stuff. That's how you fight a counterinsurgency. Nowhere was there any kind of appetite for that. It was always going to be U.S. forces. This is too hard. Even though the enemy was even more broke dickish than the Iraqi forces we had stood up, and then the ANSAF forces we stood up. So basically, we trained a bunch of, gate guards in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's why this thing's going to be a loss, because they won't be able to hang on. They've never been, sensitized to it. They've always depended on us too much. And all these guys, all you could hear about was, are we going to go to a year deployment? Are we going to go to 7-month deployment and stuff? Hey, motherfucker, it doesn't matter. The thing is this. You want to win this thing, this is a counterinsurgency now. These guys are on our side, got to be able to do this thing. We never really invested in it. We invested a shitload of money, but not the type of thought process that you guys are talking about. It stopped being maneuver warfare once Saddam's statue came down. And then it became counterinsurgency, a nasty gangster fight in both places, And both places had significant differences that aren't recognized. Well, Afghanistan and Iraq are the same. They're not. The more people you put in Iraq, the better you're going to be. The less people you put in Afghanistan, the better you're going to be.
That's exactly
the way
right.
Were, And it's like.
All right, hold on. I don't want to talk about those two theaters. So when we stop doing major formation war, then the concepts of maneuver warfare don't apply to counterinsurgency.
I think so.
You don't
think
so?
It becomes almost like talking counterinsurgency. It's partially conventional warfare, but a lot of it becomes like almost like law enforcement. It becomes more an intel war. It becomes almost more a espionage type thing, because that's how they recognize and they cede to you. They say you have won the victory. You have broken us down. You have disintegrated all our integration. You have won the maneuver warfare battle. Now we're going to resist you, though, in the counterinsurgency environment. And that's what's nasty and dirty. And, and IO is a big thing. Whenever you saw a guy with a movie camera, you knew something bad was going to happen. He's filming it so you put it on YouTube. So people in, Michigan and, in Dearborn can see it and get motivated. So it's like, it's a different situation because of technology, because of a lot of things. But it's not all just maneuver warfare, for sure.
Got it. All right. Timmy, should we close down the say-do gap in the publication, or should we leave it aspirational in nature?
I don't know how you can close down the say-do gap because – one of the things that Jeff just hit on that retards our ability to execute anything like, maneuver warfare is our rotation system, as Will pointed out, our manpower system. We do not go over to fight to win like we did in World War II. We don't have a rotation system like that anymore. And I don't see you have an aspirational doctrine that takes into account, oh, and by the way, within 6 months, we'll be, rotating you back. Because I think that eventually, the way things are going, we're going to need an aspirational doctrine that addresses what happens when you're in the fight for a couple of years at a time. Because I do believe that will happen at one point in the future again. I don't think you can ignore that. So I don't know how you have an overarching document that takes into account our self-induced friction by insisting on rotating people over and doing NCO schools in the middle of a combat zone and shit like that. That's a whole different animal, if you know what I mean. I would just keep it aspirational and ignore the say-do gap, because I just don't see how you can incorporate the say-do gap into an aspirational document without making it look depressing.
Will, final thought?
I think the technology thing can be overcome, but don't laugh at me. It takes true professional officers who get it. But when someone three levels above you in the chain of command wants instantaneous reporting, it's very difficult to allow people to go forward and execute. And the doctrine says in many ways that those people should have the best understanding of the battlefield. And so until you have officers that all fundamentally get where they're supposed to be, the guidance they're supposed to be giving, and how to measure their subordinates acting within their guidance, and that takes a very operationally focused professional officer corps, which we're never going to have, right?
Right.
Not when you do.
I thought one of the great points to reinforce what you're saying, Will, is, you know, hey, these guys had trained in the same regiments, in the same division, right? The German example, you know, for over a decade.
Yeah.
The same guys in the same billets for a long, long time.
Yeah, there's people, obviously, in the Marine Corps that are known for their expertise, and typically it's not their expertise in the operating force, because you're a platoon commander once, maybe twice, a company commander once, a battalion commander once, battalion three. I mean, yeah, you get good at it in 2 years, but then off you go to do the important stuff in the Marine Corps.
Right, right. Yeah. No, I mean, and that's just, I think that's his cultural argument about why take a second look at it. And I thought that part of it, you know, was valid. If that's your personnel system and you're not going to come off that, and you say we're going to have cohesive units, that's bullshit. We're not. So does the same system allow you to execute when you know that you're not going to have years together? Hopefully you'll have a few months together. But and to your point about expertise, I mean, I will say this. I was a B-team guy, reservist, but I worked current operations in all three of the deployments I went on, and I got really fucking good at it, right? And I mean, I was, you know, people bust my balls, one of the greatest watch officers in Marine Corps history. But you know what? I took great pride in that, and I can tell you that the only reason Kyle Carpenter's alive today is because of me and our guys. I can tell you that everybody that we went to there with puts their head on their pillow and doesn't have to worry, because I knew when to shoot and when not to shoot because I fucking paid attention, right? And that, I mean, I wish I could have been doing something else, but you know what? That's where God put me, right? And so I was going to be as good as I could be. But my point is this. When you do that shit for 2.5 years, you're fucking good, man. You're fucking good. I used to time every medevac. When we first saw the standby in a company TAC window that we had guys watching, right? And then we'd start warning people that this is coming, to include sometimes the battalion, right? And then we had this drug deal with Dustoff. They would spin when we called them, not waiting for the TAC SWO to source them. And so that's how Kyle Carpenter – but all those cheats of the system are a function of, as Picard said, expert, you know – battlefield intuition is expert knowledge. You've just done it so many times. And so to Will's point, I mean, shit, man, we have everybody's doing it for the first time. Nobody's going back there a second time as the opso. And we don't do it like that. And so it's novices over and over and over again. And so to me, I think the cultural piece resonated with me of all of it. Not so much the tactical missions, not so much, you know, that stuff, because here's what I believe. I can hear Zinni at that PME at the basic school. Someday, Zinni, you're going to be on a hill, right, with no communication, and you got to know what to do. You know, and if you can't fall back on somebody, your mission and somebody's intent to figure it out, then, you know, you're kind of screwed. Now, he kind of poo-pooed that. I was surprised. I kind of poo-pooed that. Like, oh, in this day and age of, you know, electronic interconnectedness. And he used a term for kids that were digital kids or something like that, that have only grown up in the digital age. Will they be able to function? Well, they fucking better be. Because guess what? If not, you might be fucking dead. So, anyway.
Well, it's all relative to the enemy anyway. So if the enemy's not always going to be the Japanese Imperial Marine Corps or the German Wehrmacht, it's going to be some version of the same scumbags we got now. So, you know, as long as they're better than them, we'll be okay, right?
I don't understand your point when we're talking. I don't understand your point when we're talking vis-a-vis doctrine.
Yeah. Well, no. You saying, you know, as long as our guys can, our people have the ability to do what we're talking about? I think it's because it's a competition. It's a fight between two opposing wills. As long as our opposing will is better than the other guys, we'll be all right.
Got it.
They're good compared to the guys in Vietnam or whatever, you know, or us, or it doesn't really matter, right?
Okay. No, I thought it was an interesting article. The I want to talk real quick about Jim Collins, because I push that stuff to you guys. I watched that speech three different times, and I watched it the first time just because I got curious as I was working. I thought, let me watch that whole thing, because you know, the Stockdale paradox is interesting, and I had seen a couple blurbs about him. I think because I searched on his name a couple times that popped up, so I kind of got inquisitive. Jeff, what thoughts on Jim Collins, Good to Great, and the speech he gave to honor Peter Drucker at the centennial of Drucker's birthday? You get anything? You thought? Did you find anything interesting in that? Did you take anything away from it?
I mean, well, yeah, it was interesting, and I have no bad comments to say about it. You know what I mean? It's like you just got to respect the guy's his opinion. You know what I mean? I just don't.
Got it. All right, Timmy, thoughts?
Well, I kind of thought it was analogous to the MCDP-1 article in a respect, in because I never knew that Hewlett-Packard and these guys got together and said, we're going to have a company based on principles before they ever figured out what they were going to build. That was news to me. And that was rather striking, because you don't think of American businesses as being entities which have a values that that translate to anything other than jingles on advertisements. They don't seem to have very many values at all. So I was most interested in hearing how these major corporations were built on a foundation that we would like to think that we're built on, which is a set of values that are universal. And I quite frankly had never thought that American business, and I have a business degree, I never thought it worked that way. I was stunned.
Will?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things. Item one, I've read a lot of business books. I read Good to Great. And the problem I got with all business books is that my CEOs and my bosses had never read them. Because it lays out, it's pretty simple. Second thing I would say is the Stockdale paradox sort of hit home. The idea is that you can never give up the idea that you're going to achieve, but it's horrible right now. And I got to tell you, I've probably fallen into a little bit of that recently, trying to figure out how we're going to end up achieving, because it's hard to have faith with that. Right now. And then the third thing is he could be describing, you know, the Marine Corps. And we've never been pure in anything. But how far, what are the core values? Not honor, courage, and improvement. What are the true core values of the organization? And are we straying from those core values. And I would tell you that any organization that's doing diversity based on ethnicity, race, sex, gender, etc., is straying from a core value. If they're doing diversity based on a wide spectrum of human experiences to get together teams that can contemplate and think about things in a different way, then they're going to be successful. But I'm not sure that there's a lot of organizations out there doing that, and I'm not sure that the Marine Corps is doing that. And now you're straying, and you're walking right down a path that he could describe as going to lead you to failure.
I thought that I've heard the Sockdale paradox, obviously, hundreds of times, and it's evolved in the way I hear it now. And kind of something Will said made me think of it in that. When I first used to play that little segment, I used to focus on him saying, you know, your willingness to confront the truth. And that's what I seized on. But it's funny that as I've grown, as I've done the presentation, as I've had hundreds of conversations, you know, and with you guys as part of that, I now believe that the first part of the Stockdale paradox is the single most important thing that post-traumatic winning does, and it goes back to something Will just said, is that it restores hope that there is a path for me in this blackness of life post-trauma that I live in. I've gone to therapists. I've done these things. But, you know, now it's just me. I'm trying to figure it out. I'm groping in the darkness, you know, and I kind of faking my way through it. And I get through my tough days and I just suck it up. And this is my life now. And so to me is that I believe that the most important thing post-traumatic winning does is part A of the Stockdale paradox. And it fosters the belief that you can get through it. And it reinforces that. Having said that, I thought, you know, one of the things that he said that I don't know that I've done it either formally or I haven't done it formally, and I probably have done it informally. But I think he two things. Your own personal board of directors. I thought that was a great idea. You know, he makes recommendations at the end of it, you know, to younger people, do these things. And then what's he call it? A do not do or a cease doing list. He said, we all have two do lists. He said, I would tell you have a second list that is a do not do. And then he said that list will be as important as your to do list in life. And so I thought those two little kind of things, you know, as I listened to him, were very interesting. I enjoyed thoroughly his talking about Peter Drucker, and you know, and the way Peter Drucker met when he met him, Drucker grabs Collins is nobody. He grabs his hands. He goes, "Mr. Collins, it's a pleasure to meet you." And he said, "And here I wanted to ask him all these questions, but I couldn't get a question in because he kept asking about me. That's how interested he was in me. That's how interested he was to learn from me." And I thoroughly enjoyed that. I have not listened to Good to Great, but I bought it a couple of days ago, and so I will commence listening to it. And but I just found him to be, you know, interesting based on the Stockdale paradox. And any other comments about any of his speech? Will, Tim, Jeff?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is this idea of, you know, the level five leader. It's not about you.
That's the best. You know what? I listened to it again today. What is that? Humility, selflessness, right?
Yeah. How many level five leaders do you know? And this is a rhetorical question, but how many do you know? Right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's a good question. All right, let's talk about what have you read. What are you reading? Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, you know, I bought the book by Ted Cruz about the Supreme Court.
and it's one vote away. You know, it's like all these. So I started reading that. It was good. But because I'm still reading that book that Will recommended by Gilbert about the Holocaust, which is the most, I think I'm going to have PTSD from that book because it's like it's one horrific, horrible situation after another. So to raise my morale, I picked up, I bought the book on my Kindle, Mila 18 by Leon Uris, which is about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 19, basically started on Hitler's birthday in 1943 and lasted for like 6 weeks, where these Jews actually held off the Nazis, you know, for a while. And, of course, you know how it ended, you know. But it was like almost a year to a day before Warsaw itself came under the same a similar assault by the Nazis when they decided to rise up and try to expel the Nazis before the Russians got there. And the Russians waded across the Vistula River and could have come in and helped them, but chose to just let them be decimated by the, you know, by the Nazis before they went in and took Warsaw. And it was interesting to me that situation because Leon Uris is a, you know, he wrote Battle Cry. He's an American, you know, he's a Jewish American, very proud. He wrote Exodus. He wrote a lot of those books. And Mila 18 was a very good book, you know, about that. Except now that I'm reading it, I got more of a jaundiced eye because Leon Uris is very, charitable towards Joe Stalin in this thing. If only the Poles had accepted Stalin's help, this wouldn't have happened in September 1939. And that's total bullshit, you know. Basically, Hitler and Stalin just carved up Poland like a piece of pie, you know. And so there's that. And it's interesting, though, how as you go through your life, you know, different periods, and the more you learn, the different way you look at books. It's still a great book. I'll tell you, it's very uplifting if you read Mila 18, even though it ends in the starkest of stark tragedies. You know, it's worth reading, though, absolutely. And Leon Uris's book, Exodus, is like the basically the first book that, you know, introduced that. I'd recommend, though, reading Mila 18 first and then reading Exodus. But, it's you know, that's what I'm doing now.
Got it. Tim, what are you reading?
Well, I for the same reason that I was looking at Andy Milburn's book last week, looking for stuff to, for my term paper. I'm now I found some good stuff. I appreciate your work there, Andy. I'm reading Apocalypse Never by Michael Schnellenberger. It's why environmental alarmism hurts us all, and I'm doing that because I'm taking environmental sociology, and I literally don't believe anything written in that textbook. And my professor and I are having interesting arguments in our papers back and forth, but in order to get more ammunition for my contrary view, I'm reading Apocalypse Never, and it's a good book, by the way. It's a very well researched a book by a guy with some credibility, although I'm not sure what that credibility is. I don't really know. I know he could probably know nothing. I wouldn't know, but I'm going to tell you as a consumer, he's got a lot of credibility with me.
The Elmer Gantry of consumer.
There you go. Will, what are you reading?
I'm reading Conquering Tide. It's the second of that Ian Toll series, and some great stuff. You know how Nimitz figured out how to give out awards on Guadalcanal when he got there in like the fall of 1942?
No.
Whatever he had in his pocket, that's what he gave out. That was your award system. Item two that I get out of there that's apropos for today talks about the Japanese home front recognizing that their newspapers had no credibility and what it did to morale. And then the third thing.
That's a very good lesson.
A quote from Vandegrift in here after, I think it was in September, it might have been October, September, October, when the battleships and cruisers came down and just pummeled them one night on Henderson Field. And they sort of got up in the morning, and Vandegrift said he would never judge a man suffering from combat fatigue or shell shock ever again after living through that night.
That's August 8th, man, August 8th. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, but we knew what post-traumatic stress could do to people, Vandegrift knew in 1942, and we seem to relearn it every time we go fight.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. The all right, boys. I just bought Good to Great. I'm kind of interested. But you know, I'm kind of what Will said resonates with me. You know, first thing I just the irony of him saying, you know, what made a great philanthropist, you know, not just a mediocre one, what made a great philanthropist, and that was selflessness, absolute positive selflessness. I'll kind of relate that the reading piece and what Colin says, what Will says to back to the original, you know, or the discussion about MCDP-1 and the article, The Fantasy of MCDP-1. And that is, you know, the practitioners that would be willing to read it, to conceive of it, then have the courage to do it, to build it or to be in charge of it, and then not be afraid of the risks that it takes to, you know, to be great. I mean, that's I don't care if you talk about the military or a civilian organization, that's a everything pulls you away from that. Everything pulls you away from greatness towards mediocrity. And so to me it's always an interesting study. It's always an interesting study. And one of the things that I think we in particular have been so fortunate in that, you know, we were, you know, lieutenant captains at that time. You know, in Quantico, we watched it, and I mean, even our discussions here are colored by that experience of arguing and going back and forth and researching and learning and whatnot, and we've all you know worked on practicing it in our lives, and so I think it's been something that has echoed in our lives, and so to me, it's a very, very most interesting study. But with that said, thank you very much for your opinions. I certainly appreciate them, and have a great weekend. The last thing I'll say is tomorrow is October 23rd, and certainly a day that resonates in Marine Corps history. Any final thoughts relative to October 23rd, Jeff?
Yes, when General Neller was on TV recently, I mean, I think it was 2017, where Christian Gillibrand was grilling him about this, you know, the website where right. The Marines are like
Marines United.
Disparaging female Marines. And she goes, isn't this the worst day ever for the Marine Corps? Isn't this the worst day, you know, a tragedy in the Marine Corps for this to happen? She's like doing this. And he's basically agreeing with her. And I had phone calls from guys. I had guys who – my first enlistment. I had phone calls from ETOR. But this guy from my first enlistment, who's I told you about him, he said, how about this for a fucking bad day? How about October 23rd, 1983? How about that? That's a fucking bad day for the Marine Corps. You know, he was really emotional, you know.
Right.
And what impressed me about that, he wasn't there. He was out of he got out of the Marine Corps in 1976. You know, but he had that sense of brotherhood, you know, and tragedy for what happened that day. And the same thing with ETOR, you know, ETOR, of course, didn't say that, you know, but he was like, same thing. They were like, how can you like this guy if he doesn't like stick up for those guys we knew, you know, who perished. You know? Right. So I remember that was what I think about October. I'll never not think about October 23rd without thinking about, you know, those guys at the barracks for sure.
Right, right. Timmy?
Yeah, no, it's a big day for me. I remember hearing the news on the radio, driving into the hospital there on duty. It was a weekend day. Wasn't it on a Sunday? I'm positive. I may not have been. But at any rate, I remember listening to it, and I wasn't surprised to end up there after it happened with the medical team. You know, it was such a pointless exercise too. I mean, when you're trying to pull out some good from our time in Beirut, I mean, at the end we took out the Palestinians and dumped them on the Cyprus. I guess that was nice of us, but yeah, it was, it's one of those things that makes you shake their head, because we really didn't have any business being in there. We weren't really sure what we were doing, and we sure as hell seem to have been able to figure out not to do that again. But it's a waste.
It was a Sunday.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. That's what I thought. I remember it as clear as day, as it was a Sunday morning, and I heard that happen, and I couldn't believe it. And my next thought was, I think we're on rotation, man. We're up. We're on the step up, and a few days later, we were gone.
Yeah. Will?
Yeah, you know, my first battalion was 3-8, and so there were remnants of Beirut veterans there, and I remember when they put the memorial up, and you know what the memorial says at Camp Lejeune?
They came in peace. They came
in peace.
Right.
And I wish I could remember the first guy that said it to me, that said basically, don't ever put my fucking name on a memorial that says I came in peace.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. Don't send me if I'm going in peace. And and that sort of sums up this whole idea, you know, that Tim was just saying, and you were saying, what are we doing when we do that? But you know, that feel, there were a remnant of those guys that had made the last 3-8 deployment, which I want to say was in 84 by that point.
Yes, it was.
And a couple of those guys had done cross decks. So they basically spent a year in Beirut. So that was a big deal in 8th Marines at that time.
And that was Hirsch Hernandez, Will.
Yeah. Yeah. So
Hirsch was the one who came in there last little bit, yeah.
Yeah, I did an interview with a guy by the name of Matt Gospodinovich. He was from Louisiana, and he was a Lance Corporal, and he has this big Louisiana drawl, right? And so he comes on and he talks about that day. I think they were on the guns and they had just been relieved, and they were, I don't know, they were going to go out and either go on a patrol or do something. And he said, we didn't know what the hell happened. He Lance Corporal. And so the battery gunny gets a truck, and they hop on the truck. One guy refused to go. And they head over to the barracks, and they're looking for bodies, and they're pulling guys out of the rubble, and that's what they wind up doing for the next.
Dude, he went there on a track. I remember him telling a story. He went on a track, and he said when the track door came, they were looking where the building used to be, and they just stood there and said, "Oh my God," because I could visualize that.
Right, yeah. But when you hear him, you know, he's a quintessentially Marine guy, right, with a Louisiana draw, and he's funny as hell. And he was killed a year ago in a car accident. His wife fell asleep at the wheel, I think, of their car, and he was killed at about 2 in the morning. And, you know, just one of those kind of – I played the interview, and then somebody sent me a message that said, "Hey, Mac, I'm not sure if you know, but Gospo's dead." And I was like, fuck no. And, you know, just an incredible guy. And you know, and again, that thing, you know, talk about post-traumatic winning, that thing echoed in his life, you know. And, you know, he said, "I still scuffle with it, man." He said, "That was some rough shit." And then you're supposed to come home and resume your life and all that stuff. So, I mean, it's just, so when I think of that now, I think of Ron Baskowski, you know, and the people I know, but Matt Gospodinovich is the first person I think of, because, just what a great guy, comes home and, like all the rest of them, you know, tried to get on with his life and with degrees of success and failure. And then certainly taken from us too soon. So anyway, my thoughts on that. So anyway, yeah. Go ahead, Will.
People, yeah, just, you know, interesting, I guess, was the most number of Marine casualties on any day since Iwo Jima. Yeah.
What was that day?
Was that day?
Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a big day. Yeah.
Well, and really, I mean, it's a dividing line, right? I mean, that is the dawn of an age that we don't really know about yet, right? That's coming, and we don't understand what's happened and what kind of organizations are now, yeah. Right? And we're clueless.
We couldn't believe it. There was a suicide bomber. We're like, how the hell did they get somebody to do that? We didn't understand it.
Right. I was at OCS, first time I ever saw, you know, Marines being drug out of anything. You know, I remember guys getting drug out in the red PT shorts, right? The pictures of being drug out of the building and stuff like that. And you're looking like, holy shit, man, that's the same shit we're wearing. And then Craig Timberlake, you know, walked in the squad bay and he said, see that rack right there? That lieutenant, and he said his name. He said he slept in that rack right there 10 months ago. He said, so you might want to pay attention to this shit. I was like, holy shit, man. But, yeah, no, I mean, you know, the same experience guys had when they were in recruit training and the basic school and all the training pipelines we have, right, on September 11th. Is that, hey, lest you thought this was a theoretical event, it's not. So, anyway.
Hey, man, I was recruiting then. I was recruiting in Pueblo, and people are saying, what's going on here? I go, I don't know what to say. I said, hey, you know, all I can tell you is this. Vengeance is coming.
Right. You know? Right. So right. It was such a bad story because the more you learned about it, you know, sentries there with no magazine in the weapon and, you know. It was horrible. It was horrible. Anyway, all right, boys.
And here's the irony. You know, remember the big famous story of Jimmy Howard on Howard's Hill in 488 in Vietnam in 1966, right, getting the Medal of Honor? And they kept him in that OP. And his guys had field phones down the fingers of this hill, 488, for like days when they're only supposed to be there like at the most 12 hours, you know, and they had a 2-9-2 set up. They were fucking hitting homers. The Antenna Valley bleeding into Happy Valley, and they were killing NDA with what they would do is they would call in, they'd bring in they'd see these motherfuckers. They'd call in a OV-10 or a Piper Cub, and as soon as that thing could be heard, they'd call in missions they already had, done for RD and for air, and kill a lot of people. And finally, the NDA figured it out. And came at him with 1,000 NVA regiment on the third night they were there. And they were fighting their ass off, these 18 guys against a regiment NVA. And they sent in Charlie 1-5 to try and relieve them when it was still dark. And that's my gunny in Iran was in that. It was a guy named Marshall Darling, a first lieutenant of the company commander. And he landed and tried to assault, you know, to take pressure off him. And it was pretty much a shit show, but that the guy who was in charge, the guy, the company, the recon company commander, who was being told leave those guys in there, they're hitting homers, we're getting kills. It was the same guy who was the Mao commander for the 1983 thing in Beirut. It was Garrity, you know, he was Captain Garrity in 1966, and he didn't really have a choice. He was told, hey, leave these guys in there, they're hitting homers. Believe me, we'll take care of them. And you guys know the story of those 18 guys. I think only 6 of them survived. You know, 12 of them survived, but it was devastating. You know, right. That was Garrity, same guy, and I remember him. Him remonstrating against the State Department about those rules with the magazine, the weapons bullshit, and all that stuff. And here you go. You know, terrible.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks for the visit tonight. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.